please. Oh yay, oh yay, oh yay. All persons having business before the Honorable, the United States Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia Circuit, admonish the John Mayor and give their attention to the court that now stands. God save the United States and its Honorable Court. Be seated, please. Case number 11-13-18,
Good morning, Your Honors.
Good morning.
Mary McCord on behalf of the United States. With the court's permission, I'd like to reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal. Your Honors, the district court legally erred in this case when it concluded that the defendant's statement to a Metropolitan Police Department detective were involuntarily made and therefore had to be suppressed for all purposes, including impeachment. The court erred because the court failed to apply the test for voluntariness that the Supreme Court has established for many, many decades, which is that under the totality of the circumstances, was the defendant's will overborne by police overreaching, police coercion. In this case, the district court relied almost conclusively on one circumstance, the circumstance of the detective having failed to immediately cease his interview with...
Well, that's not correct. They also relied on the fact that, on the allegations that Whalen made promises to Murdoch, right, and threatened him.
No, appellee on appeal, appellant, so I'm going to probably misstate a few times here. On appeal, appellee asserts that there were promises and threats made. That argument was never made below, nor did the district court rely on it. And
well, if we decided there was sufficient evidence for that, what does that do to your analysis?
Well, I believe there's not sufficient evidence of that. I
agreed with that.
But if the court thinks that there were any type of promises made, it could certainly look to what that promise was and what effect that had in the totality of the circumstances. We believe there were no promises made and that, in fact, what was said here, and certainly, let me just emphasize, if the court looks at not only the district court's written orders, but also the transcript of the argument on the motions, it'll see that that is not at all what the district court was relying on. The district court on May the 24th at page 101 stated that the issue to the court was, did the defendant have a right to remain silent and not have the detective ask him 5 zillion questions? When the prosecutor brought up the fact to the district court that the defendant was not arguing that his statements were involuntary because they were the product of a lengthy detention or deprivation of food or water or beating or threats, the court agreed and said, no, nothing like that. So quite clearly here, the court was relying on the fact that there was a Miranda violation. Now, she did also mention two other facts, that the defendant was in custody and that he was facing serious charges and had been told he would be arrested and extradited to face these murder charges. But these two circumstances are inherent in any custodial interrogation where the defendant is facing a serious charge. So the only real circumstance that was influencing the court's decision was the Miranda violation. The Supreme Court, however, for decades, dating back at least to the early 70s in the cases of Harris v. New York and Oregon v. Haas, has made it clear that a Miranda violation is not the sine qua non of voluntariness or involuntariness. And the fact that the police violate Miranda does not require that a subsequent statement be suppressed for all purposes when the statement is voluntarily made. And instead, and the court made this clear in Haas, the normal tests for voluntariness and trustworthiness should apply.
You're limiting all this to a situation like this case where the government only plans to use it for cross-examination purposes, right?
That's correct.
You're not making a broader argument about
that? No, I'm not at all. This is strictly consistent with the Supreme Court's teaching in Harris and Haas, which is that a voluntary statement, even taken in violation of Miranda, shouldn't be a license for a defendant to take the stand and testify without concern about being impeached with prior inconsistent statements that were voluntarily made. And in Haas, in fact, is a case where the defendant had not just a case where warnings hadn't been given, but Haas was a case where the defendant had actually asserted his right to counsel, which of course didn't happen here. Here we only had an indication that the defendant wasn't interested in talking to the police officer about the murder of Prince Wright, never had an invocation of the right to counsel. And in Haas, the Supreme Court looked at that and said, this is no different, doesn't require a different analysis than when there's a failure to warn, because the impeachment value of being able to cross-examine a defendant who testifies with voluntarily made statements is an important impeachment value, and the deterrence from Miranda from not being able to use a statement obtained in violation of Miranda in the government's case in chief is sufficient deterrent. It doesn't need to be suppressed for all purposes, at least when it's voluntary. Here, we believe that a proper, and I should just emphasize, this has been repeatedly, this refrain has been repeatedly stated by the Supreme Court over the years. In Oregon v. Elstat, when the court actually declared that it would, there is no warrant for presuming coercive effect where the suspect's initial inculpatory statement, though technically in violation of Miranda, was voluntary. And that, of course, is a case where it was an inculpatory statement, not an exculpatory statement, when we have here. U.S. v. Patain, when the Supreme Court refused to apply the fruit of the poisonous tree doctrine to Miranda violations. And then most recently, just a few months ago, in Bobby v. Dixon, the Supreme Court emphasized again that the mere fact of a Miranda violation doesn't render subsequent statements involuntary. And I think Dixon's an important case. We sent a 28J letter about this because it was just decided in November. I think it's an important case for the analysis for another reason as well. In that case, one of the points that the Supreme Court emphasized about why the defendant's statement, initial interrogation statement in that case before Wright's, which was in violation of Miranda, was voluntary, was the fact that the defendant had maintained his innocence throughout the statement, his innocence of a murder. He had never capitulated to any kind of coercive pressure. And that's a fact in this case as well. The interview lasted about an hour and 10 minutes, and never did the defendant during the course of that interview make any inculpatory statements. He maintained that he had nothing to do with the murder of Prince Wright, that he wasn't in the house when it occurred, and therefore he couldn't speak to it. So when assessing whether his will was overborne, I think the Supreme Court has now agreed that that's an important consideration, but certainly not the only consideration. And in this case, a proper assessment of the factors reveals that we have a 33-year-old adult with a serious history of previous incarceration and arrests. He admitted in his interview he'd been incarcerated for 10 years. He knew the victim from being incarcerated with him in Hagerstown. He was, in fact, in jail on other pending charges when he was brought for questioning. He was provided with water. He was interviewed in a standard-size interview room, just a little bit over an hour. He was confronted with his predicament that there was a warrant for his arrest, but all the information provided him was truthful information. He maintained his innocence throughout his interview, and he expressed familiarity with the system. If the court listens, they will hear he's very nonchalant throughout the interview. He, at the end, talks about, "You're just doing your job as a detective. We'll deal with this when I get down with my attorney. In fact, I think federal trumps state," he muses. And then he even jokes with the detective about his alias, saying, "Well, I use alias when I deal with the females, because when you're tall like this, it's easy to get it back to your girlfriend." These are not statements of a man whose will was overborne, and we'd ask this court to reverse the holding of the district court and allow the admission of this statement for impeachment purposes only, Your Honors, at a trial in this matter.
Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honor. David Voss on behalf of Mr. Murdoch. Judge Griffith, let me just address the question that you started out with government counsel. There was a promise that was made in this case, and that's what makes this case so much different than the other cases that the government cites in its pleadings. And that's the promise of, I can stop the process. And in fact, the promise that was made by Detective Whalen was the ultimate promise that any suspect could receive from an interrogating officer. I can make this whole thing go away.
Wasn't that statement just, yeah, I can stop, you know, you give us a good, if the story's good, we can stop the process. It wasn't a promise to stop the process under any circumstances.
Your Honor, I think that the reasonable interpretation from Mr. Murdoch was that if I gave you a statement, if I talked to you, that this case very well may go away. I don't believe that means it stops the process. If you give me a statement, there's no longer going to be an interview. I think certainly Detective Whalen was saying, I'm investigating this murder. You know, maybe I can exonerate you, but I can't do that unless you give me some information. And again, the reason why I think that promise is so powerful in this context is that Detective Whalen brings Mr. Murdoch into the homicide office, sits him down in an interrogation room with another police officer, and says, I have started this process. I'm the one who got the warrant. I'm the one who's doing the investigation. And you are basically at your liberty, is at my disposal. And what he says is, you're going to be extradited. You're going to be brought down to Washington, D.C. You're going to be facing these charges. Now, there's one way you can stop that from happening, and that's if you talk to me.
Let me take you back to the district court's, what Ms. McCord's point about what the district court said for just a minute.
Yes, Your Honor.
The district court said, said his will was not overborne, and she gave three reasons. The defendant was already in custody. He was facing a third-degree murder charge and the Miranda violation, right?
No, I don't believe that she said that those were the only three reasons.
I'm just reading you from her order.
Right, Your Honor, but she said that her order was based on a totality of the facts and then later a totality of the
circumstances. But you would agree that those are not sufficient, right?
Oh, that's correct, Your Honor.
Any problem with that?
That's correct, Your Honor. In fact, and what we argued, Your Honor, is that you can't take those out of the context of the entire interrogation. And I guess most importantly, Your Honor, and this gets back to your question, Judge Griffin, is that in the government's motion to reconsider, they basically make the same argument that they're making here today to the district court. And that is, wait a minute, Judge, you're equating the Miranda violation with a finding that the statement was involuntary. And the court rejects that characterization of her decision. In fact, says, no, I've reconsidered my earlier decision, and based on the totality of the circumstances, that's why I believe that this statement was involuntary. And I think that the court needs to be mindful of exactly the context in which promise was made. Because I don't think that the court can go back, well, I think that the court should go back and take a look at the timeline. Because what happens is Mr. Whalen initially talks to Mr. Murdoch and says, I'd like to ask some questions of you. I want you to listen to what I have to say. And Mr. Murdoch, and this may be your only opportunity to speak. And the first time that Mr. Murdoch says anything, it is an indication that he does not want to speak. We'll go to court, is what he says. And it's at that point that Detective Whalen basically changes up his strategy, and that's when he starts talking about that the ball is rolling, the ball is rolling, the ball is rolling, but I'm the one who can stop that ball.
Are you saying that the case, as Whalen knew it at the time, was so absolutely overwhelming that a contingent promise to stop in the event of truthful, exculpatory information would have availed nothing?
Well, of course, Mr. Murdoch couldn't have known whether or not that, in fact, would happen, but he did know that he was told.
Well, he presumably knows the facts that he knows, right? That is to say, he knows what his role was.
Well,
and if his role is one of complete innocence, he can come forward with that.
Of course.
And what I'm asking you I'm trying to get at the truthfulness or lack of it in the, quote, promise by Whalen, if it was possible that an answer could come that would be genuinely exculpatory, that would make the promise a legitimate one.
It could be, but I think the difference in this case is we're not dealing with a suspect who's just been arrested, but rather this is a suspect that the warrant has been sought out for his arrest three months earlier.
But you aren't answering my initial question, which was, with the facts as we may impute them to Whalen at the time, so absolutely overwhelming that a request for your client's position was necessarily a facade, a trick.
Well, yeah, I guess the answer to the question is we don't know. But I don't think that that's what the focus of the inquiry should be, that the focus of the inquiry is
if it's a perfectly legitimate promise, and what you say suggests we have no reason to think it wasn't a perfectly legitimate promise, why should we be worried about it? Why should that
be
characterized as producing an involuntary statement?
Well, Judge Williams, I don't think you should necessarily assume that that was a legitimate promise when it's given in the context of that the warrant has already been sought and obtained. In fact, you know, our position is that that was not a legitimate promise, but rather that that was an inducement to try and get Mr. Murdoch to begin talking. I know that doesn't exactly answer your question, but again, I think it's you're assuming, there's assumption for which there's no basis at this point, and the inference is certainly to the contrary.
And so the government cites a series of cases to support its argument that the standard is will, whether the defendant's will was overborne here, right?
I mean,
that's the standard.
Go ahead. I'm sorry, Your Honor.
I'm sorry. Isn't that that is the standard, right?
Well, I think the standard actually in column is whether or not the decision was essentially free and unconstrained by its maker.
Yeah.
And again, I mean, the problem is that there's kind of three different analyses.
My point is that the government cites a whole series of cases where courts have found that standard met that look very, very different from this case.
Right.
Here's one, 4 hours of interrogation. Well, he was incapacitated in an ICU. 8 hours of interrogation in a small crowded room, despite police knowledge that the defendant had mental problems. Administered truth serum. I mean, the government's point is, this case doesn't look anything like the kinds of cases where courts have found a standard met.
Right, Your Honor, and I guess what our position is, because the government has cited what maybe be the outside limits, doesn't mean that there's something that's inside the limits that would still cause somebody to make a decision.
Do you have any case that is like this one?
No, I don't, Your Honor, but nor does the government have a case.
What's the rule that we would apply based on?
Yeah, I think the rule that you would apply is again, this is why we kind of want to get away from whether or not these are threats and promises, but rather look at the officer's conduct. Did the officer's conduct induce the suspect to make a statement that he otherwise would not have freely chosen to make?
In a sense, that's necessarily true, right? I mean, they were having a conversation, and without the conversation, the defendant wouldn't have said anything.
Well, here's the difference, Your Honor. This is not a situation where the defendant is, you know, trying to calculate, well, gee, can I make a conversation? You know, should I make it? Am I going to make a choice whether or not I'm going to make a statement? And maybe I'll divulge some information. You know, that there's a colloquy that's going back and forth where Detective Whalen's kind of pushing and prodding Mr. Murdoch. Mr. Murdoch is pushing and prodding Detective Whalen. This is Detective Whalen launching this broadside against Mr. Murdoch. And then again, most importantly, it's after Mr. Murdoch has indicated that he does not want to discuss the case. Now, this is before the actual Miranda violation that happened at the 8-minute mark. Again, below and here, our argument has always been that the court needs to focus on the prior 8 minutes leading up to the Miranda violation. Now, the court can't ignore that the Miranda violation has an impact on the voluntariness issue. But we never argued it below. The court certainly never found that the Miranda violation itself led to an involuntary statement made by Mr. Murdoch. Your Honor, if I could just, in my last 30 seconds, just to address the Dixon case. I don't think the Dixon case really has any assist the court in any way in this case, because in that case what happened was Mr. Dixon was the one who reinitiated the contact in that case. Then he made the waiver, and then he made the statements to the police. And so there's no indication at all that his will was overborne. In fact, he signed a statement saying, my will was not overborne. That's not the case in this case. In fact, what you have is when the Miranda violation or when Miranda violation came, when he was read his Miranda rights, in the same breath that Detective Whalen gave him his rights, he indicated to him that he was not going to honor those rights. And that was that I'm going to read you your rights, but I'm going to ask you some questions later. So just like he controlled when this case stopped or started, when he can control this case would stop, and also whether or not Mr. Murdoch had an opportunity not to discuss this case, that was in control of Detective.
Okay. Thank you. Did Ms. McCord have any more time? Do you like it?
Your Honor, just briefly, I would just point out with regard to promises, as we've indicated in our reply brief, we don't believe any promise was made here. Detective Whalen simply said, the ball is rolling, I have an arrest warrant, you can talk to me, I'll look into it. He made no promise. The kind of promises that distort rational choice are promises that historically, you know, there's a lynch mob outside the jail and the detective says, I can stop them from coming in if you talk to me, otherwise they're coming in. There's a small, slight defendant incarcerated and a gang member's after him, and the government informant says, I can protect you from them if you talk to the police. These are the kind of cases where promises have been held to overbear the will of the defendant. And I would just point the court, and it's a far cry from what we have here, and it's a far cry from things even that this court has upheld. In the Robinson case, 1983, cited at our reply brief at page 7, a promise that the suspect's cooperation would be made known to the prosecution and a promise not to arrest the suspect that very day were held not to be sufficient to overbear the suspect's free will. Those were, we think, that was quite rightly decided, but even those promises were more significant than what you have here. Thank you, Your Honor. We'd ask
Ms. McCord and Mr. Both, thank you very much. The case is submitted.